Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick, and today, on August 21st, 2009, I am delighted to have the organizer of FailCon, Cassie Phillips, on this week's edition. Welcome to the show, Cassie.
Thanks, Jennifer. Glad to be here.
I have to say, you know, as we've talked about before when I was, you know, intrigued and invited you on the program, normally we talk to the kind of people that you wouldn't associate with failure. Influencers we think of as being, you know, highly successful and, you know, they drive engagement, they drive page views, they drive all the things that we think of as successful. And you're organizing an event around the concept of failure in a sense. You want to talk about what led to that, you know, the genesis of FailCon and what you think, you know, just talk about the journey of a little bit, if you can, how you got to a conference called FailCon.
Happy to. FailCon, just for some background, is going to be my sixth conference in the social media world, sixth or seventh. And it kind of, it came from those past experiences where I'd been putting on these conferences, Snap Summit, based on social media, the social media world, the social web. And I kept bringing these influencers and these developers and founders to the stage. And they're all great. They have great things to say. But you start to hear the same stories a lot. And a lot of it is talking about how to find success and what they did to find success. And I started to feel like a lot of it is luck. And there's a lot of skill involved. I don't want to undercut them at all. But I feel like we learn a lot more from our failures. And it's interesting to hear, you know, one of our speakers, Max Levchin, to talk about some of his early startups even before PayPal, and then how those prepared him for, you know, the teamwork at PayPal, and then how mistakes at PayPal led to Slide. Or Sandy from Mevo talking about early team development and what's necessary there and where miscommunication happened. Because I felt like it's more in our failures that we share a lot of things, and it's from mistakes that we learn more. A lot of the mistakes make it very clear what not to do, where what to do can be a lot harder to pin down. That's right. The point of the conference is to leave us all feeling inspired as entrepreneurs, where if you're, I honestly think, and this might be a harsh statement, but if you think you won't fail, or if you're afraid to face your failures, you probably shouldn't go into the entrepreneurial world, just because there's some insane rate, like, what is it, 8 out of every 10 startups will fail, something crazy.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, so just the day itself will be about how these failures led to success, and how we shouldn't be afraid of these failures or have them stop us from being successful, because that's, you know, impossible. So it's most of the day is focused on that.
Yeah, not to interrupt you, but one of the things I was really thinking about when inviting you onto the show was, you have this amazing speaker list, and for anyone that wants to go to FailCon, you can go to my website, jenniferlindsay.com, or you can just go to snapsummit.com, and you see the speaker list, and, you know, it's the who's who, some of whom have been on this show. And what I wondered initially was, with the name, did you have any sort of reluctance on the part of people to participate? Anybody that didn't want to share or point, you know, really analyze failure? Or do you feel like that's a trait? Because what I'm wondering is that kind of a trait of someone who is successful in the entrepreneurial world, that you're kind of able to honestly look at those things? Or did you find any resistance anywhere?
I found surprisingly little resistance. And I think what you said rings true is I am in the speaker list looking for people in the end who found success, because that indicates that, you know, they still have the tenacity to get there. And I think that I actually recently read a study, because I've been now doing all this research on failure, oddly enough, that most of the most successful doctors, as med students, their professors say they were usually kind of the hardest on themselves. They really criticized their personal mistakes and took it really personally, but also looked at them, you know, with a rational eye and got over it. I think that rings true in this field, too, where when you to be successful, you have to be able to look back on your failures. And so I've had surprisingly little resistance. The hardest thing has been some of the investors, because obviously when they talk about investment failure, they don't want to bring up, you know, the company name and point fingers. Exactly. And that's, I understand. So on that panel, I've made it a thing where you don't need, there's a panel for people listening in on when investors make failures or make investments that fail, how do they handle the company? What do they do? And so I've made, with that, I've said you don't need to name the company that failed. You don't need to, you know, point fingers at the CEO or whatever. So there are a few things that's like, it is a topic we need to be careful with. We don't want to shift blame, nor do we want to start attacking the speaker. But in general, I've had surprisingly little resistance. More of the resistance has actually come, actually not very much resistance, but there's a little bit of resistance when I'll bring it up at a mixer, and there'll be one guy in a group of five who will say, well, I want to listen to failure. But usually what's funny is one of his friends will pipe up and say, why wouldn't you want to listen? So it is a nice topic that it kind of defends itself when someone does criticize it.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens, isn't it? The wonderful thing about the social web is for every person that decides to be a naysayer, you still get the crowd's opinion loud and clear, usually.
Right.
But one of the things that I think was fascinating that you touched on was it sounds like you're doing some research around failure, and I'm wondering if there are any other touch points that you see, because it sounds almost like, you know, type A personality, you know, where, you know, kind of the tenacious type of person, but yet there are those that, you know, you wouldn't consider type A that you know are successful that have had failure. What do you find as sort of common threads of those that are able to weather the tides both up and down?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it is definitely mostly type A personalities. In general, it's people that have, I think they've come to a good position to look back on their life. I don't want to say it's necessarily age in years, because mm-hmm. that's so, you know, just a number.
Yeah.
But an age and experience where you don't need to be a social guru, nor do you need to have four companies under your belt. It could be your first company. But to take the ability to step back from your passion for a moment, which is a thing that I think is hard for a lot of the CEO founders, where they're so passionate about their idea, it's very hard to take a rational step back, distance yourself from it. And that's why I'm one of the people that's strongly behind a team of founders to get two or three. To have one that's passionate and driven and knows that every idea is right, and then to have another one that's like, well, just a minute, let's look at that, let's just stop for a second.
Reality check, kind of.
Right, and to not be too much of like a negative Nelly here, but to be able to objectively look at what they're doing. I think that's a common thing of either one founder who's successful or the team, is that there's got to be a passion and a drive, but there also needs to be someone who can put the brakes on for a minute and reassess everything, and an ability to calmly meet up and talk about what went wrong. I just wrapped up we had fun, but a startup that we tried. And when we wrapped it up, the three of us met for lunch and just talked about, well, why are we ending it? What went wrong? What could we fix next time? What have we all learned? And I think we all left on a great note. We felt really good about it, and we all are better prepared for our next endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think that's a really common tie.
I think one of the things about tech is the importance of the postmortem, and sounds like that's kind of what you did. You know, it's more fun or not depends on the group of people, of course, and how
mm-hmm.
serious the loss was in terms of money and time. But, you
mm-hmm.
know, that's clearly, you know, I've worked at organizations that avoid the postmortem, and to me that's a sign of trouble.
Yep.
If you don't come together and look each other in the eye and go, I see that as your fault, or whatever needs to be said,
mm-hmm.
or I take responsibility for this. I mean, it's amazing how sometimes, you know, just saying, hands up, I was wrong, can,
mm-hmm.
you know, really bring something forward as opposed to bring it backwards. But, you know, sort of getting back to your guest list, I know you've been bombarded with requests all across the board.
Surprisingly.
Yeah, so you seem surprised by that. So I was curious, so what kind of were your expectations going into creating this event that has blossomed into something bigger than it sounds like you expected?
Yeah, it's hard to say what my expectations were. I tend to be in a partnership, the one who's more, what some people would say negative, some people would say realistic, about the event. So I definitely didn't set my hopes very high. I was not expecting people like Max Levchin, Mark Pincus, Sandy Jen. We're actually talking with Lynn Johnson, Ron Conway. I wasn't expecting that at all. I didn't think we'd get to names like that. I didn't know that they'd want to share their stories. And surprisingly, I was not expecting, as you put it, the bombardment of everyone just wanting to come together and share their own stories. People who haven't even found success yet just saying, hey, I want to be on stage for 10 minutes just to let people know this really stupid mistake I made. And here's what I did, and here's what I learned. And just, again, what I said earlier, that it is this failure is this thing that really can unify a lot of entrepreneurs. And I was surprised how many entrepreneurs are really comfortable just taking some personal blame and being like, wow, this went wrong, here's how I fixed it, or here's what I learned, or here's how I wrapped it all up and didn't hurt too many feelings. And just how comfortable everyone was to reach out and be like, sure, I'll tell my story too. That's great. So it's been a really, part of why I got into the organizational field was to bring a community together. And it's been a really wonderful event to feel this community energy that we all have, and how much we want to help one another in the startup world.
Right. And the interesting thing is, you know, and I said this in my blog post, I'll say it again, that, you know, those of us that were around for the first dot boom and dot bust, I guess both, to see the highs of the high and the low of the low, that are seeing some of that behavior repeat, but a lot of it with very quick course correction. So, you know, I'm seeing people kind of quickly, you know, oh, that's not right, you know, and move away from something that feels wrong.
Right.
But you're getting names that are kind of outside of some of the names are sort of outside that loop, or some of them may be even young enough that they don't remember or weren't around for the first dot boom dot bust. How much of a correlation is there, you think, between sort of analyzing the past from a sort of Silicon Valley, Bay Area, San Francisco perspective versus failure as a thread through kind of, you know, capitalism, really?
As we can see in the economy now. attacking the question, I think that the important thing with a lot of the youth, and this is more coming from personal experience than watching people, is that it is definitely necessary. I think the past is what drives us and is what is teaching us now. I think a lot of the Silicon Valley attitudes, both the positive and the negative, a big thing is our ability to just cope with failure, that investors will reinvest in someone who had a bust. And I think that what's necessary is that we are able to see the past. I'm always hesitant when I see a team of just 22 and 23-year-olds, and I wonder where is that older advisor who saw the failures of the past and are able to make a comment on it, help you shape your product. So I think that I do think that the past is a major driving force. I think it's something that is definitely necessary on a team. I don't know. Speaking as I'm one of the younger crew out there, and I still can get that feeling of I'm immortal, my ideas are great, of course they're going to succeed. And so I always, one of our advisors for our last company was Steve Newcomb from Vergence, and Ro from Rock U, and being able to sit with them and just talk through step by step some of the mistakes they saw in the early dot-com boom and bust, where they're seeing us go down the same path, how to veer off of it. So I definitely think it's that Silicon Valley is very much touched by, you know, the boom and bust back, what was it, like 8 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, I consider it like the last decade because it was like there was the before and then the during and after the whole process. So it was very different at different stages, even in, you know, in terms of, you know, the watering hole you go to, right? So that this,
right,
you know, would the faces be the same? Would they be different? Had people moved to the suburbs because it was cheaper? You know, that kind of stuff. played hugely into even my social group changing.
Right.
And I'm sure that happened for other people as well.
Mm-hmm. So I do think something about the bust also kind of leveled the playing field, and it gave a lot of the younger generation a chance to come ahead. Because some of the older generation now, I talk to them, and they're like, well, of course, we're still entrepreneurs, but you have the passion and the energy of the youth versus, you know, the experience of the older people. Had there not been, I do think that had there not been a bust, which I think many might say there had to be a bust, but had there not been in the theoretical world, I don't know that the youth nowadays could have been doing as much as they're doing had all these other companies continued being out there. So even more than just the idea of capitalism, I do think it was, you know, the boom and bust of the 90s and the early 2000s that is shaping who we are now and what we do and how we approach things. And why failure can be such a great topic is, you know, I think it is part of what made this community what it is.
So one of the things that I wanted to pick up on was the idea of investors and sort of the wise man at the table or the wise woman at the table that's supposed to be the guiding influence of the two Stanford MBAs, right? The typical wonder kid scenario, right?
Right.
We're seeing, you know, I think that there's some identifiable trends of, you know, what, you know, if Sequoia Capital is suddenly saying this is how you handle your communication strategy or who you should go to, or if, you know, or equally large individual investors or, you know, kind of the brain trust that is the venture capital community, I'm seeing a lot of sort of group decision making, it feels like. And I wonder if there's anyone you've talked to that talks about whether they that brain trust and however the whoever has the first idea, and I don't know how the idea catches fire, but you see that happen. And I'm wondering if you see any trends where that brain trust was a failure, because one of the things that I see now is there's guidance and counsel that young people are being given and perceptions that they make because of that that maybe aren't right or seem off-key. Does that
make
sense?
It does. It also ties into, I'm actually having one of the talks is on that, is the early structure of who's in your brain trust. I've noticed a lot of entrepreneurs that I speak with like to formulate their original idea, the first idea, on their own with some very disconnected advisors, people they have no real personal investment in the company,
right.
But who meet with them once every few weeks and just bounce some ideas, help them shape it. As I said, I'm still a fan of the team. I would like to have two people, two or three. But I can understand in early phases, I think it is important when you're first generating the idea to not get too much criticism on it. I think part of what the youth, and not necessarily by age, but by, you know, a 40-year-old who's young at heart, is the energy and the passion that they bring. And I think it's dangerous to put too many advisors in a room and over-talk the idea too much, to over-analyze it, to pick it apart, to make it have too many details than it needs. So I definitely think that, or my advice to any entrepreneur out there is when you first have the idea, kind of chew on it for a while on your own, formulate it, think about it, answer some of the key questions, read the blogs. I read a lot of blogs on what questions should you be asking yourself. And so I see a lot less for investors and more for very small advisors in the early phases. I'm also a big fan of telling people don't go for VC money unless you really, really have to. Do you really need $2 million to build a piece of equipment or something like that? Go for just an angel if you need the money, just one person who you trust, you're close to, who creates a really good dynamic. I'm also a fan of more like Socratic methods where have the advisor ask questions rather than specifically critique the product. Who is your main audience? How are you going to reach them? Have you emailed some people in it to see if they like the idea? Which then doesn't so much stifle your creativity as just helps you guide it. Because I definitely think that some failures come from overanalysis, too many cooks in the pot, too big a team, or, right, a Sequoia Capital investing too early, which I don't think they do much anymore. But if they were, hypothetically speaking, you know, to kind of quell that passion that is also needed, that fire that's really needed to get the idea off the ground.
Yeah.
But I don't really think it's a risk, yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's something to that, you know, and I wonder if there's, in forming a conference like this, again, kind of going back to the genesis of it, if you had a sense of kind of, you know, how much of the investor community you wanted, I mean, what identifiable communities you wanted to have as participants, ideally, in the conference for you to feel like this is a successful conference when you started, when you came up with the idea or you know, started with this and ran with it, what were those contingent groups, or did you have contingent groups that you were thinking needed to be there?
Needed to be in the audience?
No,
or
needed
on stage.
To be speakers, yeah. Mm. Needed, or you were hoping that, you know, had success stories and obviously, you know, failures that they would share, but you felt needed to kind of be there to represent the full
right.
spectrum of entrepreneurship and
right.
making a successful product.
Yeah, that's definitely the point. I wanted to make sure with the conference that it wasn't, you know, 20 speakers all talking about sounding mistakes, because that would tend to get pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually sat down and thought about what all the steps of becoming an entrepreneur and having a successful company are, and I'm actually still working on a few of them, but fitting one person for each. The ones that came to mind for me were I wanted a group that had a founding team that had stuck together through the entire process to talk about early team development. I definitely wanted a panel of investors to talk about investment, how they invest, how they handle a failed investment. But ideally to have that be like an angel, a VC, an incubator, you know, a range of investment levels. I definitely wanted a designer on stage. I wanted to talk about early UI, you know, early interface, how to do
great
beta
point.
Testing,
great.
When to bring in alpha testers.
A-B
I definitely
testing,
wanted
the whole range.
Right. And then product was big, too. I definitely wanted someone on product to talk about that. And then I knew that I, of course, wanted to get a couple of the big names that everybody knew. And now I'm actually on the hunt for the little names that nobody really knows, people that are rising stars or have an interesting take on the situation. Maybe they started a lifestyle website. You know, they're not the same faces that we see on stage all the time. So I knew ahead of time that I wanted some old faces with new stories that were famous founders, some people that none of us knew that had funny stories, investors, a designer, and, like, a team to talk.
So you don't have to reveal who, but I'm curious if you had a list of names versus companies going into this.
Mm-hmm. I have some.
Targets.
Right. One of the ones I didn't get, my failure, I'm still working on. I definitely, for product, wanted a company that had a lot of good products and a few bad ones. So I spoke with Microsoft. I'm still kind of talking with them. I'm speaking with HP to get that filled. Apple was definitely on the list. Nintendo was on the list for that slot. As far as investors go, I definitely had, like, Paul Graham, who is tentative right now, Ron Conway, who I believe is secured, but I have a partner in crime working on the investment panel. So that was on there. I knew a lot more women. I went to Julie Wainwright, CEO of Pets.com when it closed. And she and I spoke for a long time. She's actually really interested in the conference. Her new company, however, is taking off, so kudos to her, SmartNow.com. So she doesn't know
yeah.
that she can make it. So she's,
you know,
I've taken her off the list for now. But
yeah, that one is, Pets.com was one of those ones where when it died, that and what was it, Cosmo or... I can't remember.
eToys was a big one.
Yeah, it was the delivery. It was the delivery service. So when you worked at a startup, you know, they had pretty much everything there for you in terms of sodas and stuff. But if you wanted ice cream and a DVD to listen to in the background, you know, they would deliver it right to you.
Right, I remember that one. That's awesome.
I mean, everybody loved it, and everybody goes, why didn't that work? And, you know, the conclusion, and when I spoke with Guy Kawasaki a few weeks ago, you know, he was saying, you know, it's sort of like Webvan. You know, those that used it loved
right.
it, but it's so hard to monetize those services.
Right.
You just have no idea what demand's going to be. So, you know, those are, you know, I think some of the ones like pets.com where you're like, everybody loves pets. If you do a, you know, I come from the TV world. If you do a pet contest, you have, you know, you know, it's through the roof, right? I mean, we all love our pets. I mean, I think my pets are, you know, the stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that that went, you know, when that went under, I still, in fact, I was in the city yesterday, and I drove by where their offices were, because I remember seeing people take their pets to work, which was one of their their little perks, and I thought about pets.com. So it, I think it'll be interesting to see what resonates in the audience, too, like that, like, ah, I remember them, or why didn't that work? That was such a great service, and I think that's good, too.
And yes, because she, as I warned, I don't she think she can confirm her new company is going really well. But I'm looking for someone from that era, eToys.com. I'm trying to reach out to. If anyone listening has a contact, I would love to know. Or any other major .com boom and bust that resonates with us. Both because you do wonder what exactly happened aside from major market collapse. But my interesting story is, what do you do when literally it is out of your hands? You know, where it's like by the time Pets.com was going under, I highly doubt you could really blame any single person there. You know, it's just the economy was going down and everyone's pulling their money out. And so the talk there was more like, okay, you've done everything you can and failure is still imminent.
Right.
What do you do? You know, how do you handle laying off hundreds of people, millions of dollars of investment? And then how do you recover? You know, how do you emotionally, physically, and monetarily get yourself back, you know? And so Julie was a great example of, she started a new company, and it's, you know, it's not pets.com, but it's paying her bills, and it's, she's got employees, and that's wonderful.
Which is great for her, you know.
Right.
Awesome. Kudos to her. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, was sort of the definition of failure, and I preface that by saying, you know, one of the companies that a lot of people that I know in the social media world have kind of, you know, whispered under their breath about is eBay or companies like eBay, you know, and Microsoft.
Yep, I've had a lot of people bring that up for me
too. Yeah, right. Yep. Waterfall technology, you know, technology development cycles. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't evolve quickly enough, and they still have their loyal contingency. I mean, my in-laws live in the UK, and they, you know, live in the north, and they live and die. They buy everything, pretty much everything besides, I mean, even some food stuff they buy on eBay.
It's terrible.
I mean, it's just, it's insane. But they, I mean, literally, it's when we go, you know, for Christmas or birthdays or whatever, it's a no-brainer. You get them an eBay certificate. That's
right.
That's what you get them. It's the most useful.
Well,
But I look at that company and I hear the rumblings, obviously, some of it based because there's been layoffs. But, you know, God, why didn't they capitalize on this? And now you're starting to see kind of the bleeding has stopped, and they seem to be coming back. I mean, they're resurging with some widgets.
Yeah, stabilized out a little bit. Yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you have, is that the idea of bringing in, like, say, a Microsoft, which we know isn't going out of business, but it definitely has, you know, it has, I mean, it, first of all, it has a presence in San Francisco and in the Silicon Valley, and, you know, it, there's definitely successes and failures with their R&D unit, especially that's here, with, you know, wanting to share at that level. Is that where you're finding, I mean, you'd mentioned earlier, you know, they haven't signed on, but it's kind of in their interest to sign on, don't you think?
I mean, I of course am biased. I personally think that, especially in the social media world, being open about your mistakes and being open about things that went wrong is the right way to handle any situation. That said, in any huge company, I knew those would be my hardest ones to get because there's so much PR. There's so many levels. I've gone through 4 or 5 introductions at Microsoft just to be like, no, I can't handle it. Here's the next person. And I don't get mad at any of those people because I know it's, you know, there's a lot of levels you have to get through. That said, yes, personally, I think it would be in their best interest to send someone, talk about like Microsoft Bob or, well, someone I just heard about, HP launched something a couple years back. I don't remember what it was now, but I remember someone telling me, they're like, oh, it was a dud. You need to get them in and talking about it.
What about the resurgence of products? So one of the things is tablets. Tablets are back in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
I want a tablet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what
to totally
buy.
I totally want a tablet.
I was at my doctor's office the other day, and, you know, she's writing notes on the tablet that were immediately going to the front desk. And I was just like, this is so freaking cool. This is how, you know, people order food in restaurants this way. Why haven't doctor's offices worked this efficiently forever? And, of course, there's the investment and all of that.
But
were there products like that where you know, anything that you can point to that is, you know, is a comeback story in terms of a product where people are like looking at it in a completely different way or don't know why tablets didn't take off in the first place?
Right. It's hard to say. I mean, I don't have anything quite as good as tablets. Like, tablets are a great one. I'm a Palm user. I use Palm Centro. I'm looking to get the Palm Pre. And I remember back in high school, my parents buying me a Palm, one of the little, you know, they weren't little, the giant things. And they were touchscreen. You had a touchscreen Palm, or I believe mine was. Yeah,
I
you could write on it.
Spring, believe it
or
not.
Yeah. And they were these touchscreen things, and you could literally write on them. And then I went through some of college, late high school and college, and nobody had one. And then the BlackBerry came. Everyone had a BlackBerry, but it wasn't touchscreen, so I didn't get it. Like, I was like, I had a touchscreen thing. And now we've got iPhone and Palm and phone integration. So it's not quite as good a story, but they are out there. I mean, I'm still kind of a fan of Palm. I really like their interface. I like how organized they are. And so that was definitely something that it was out and popular for a while, and then something happened, and it went away, you know, and now it's coming back.
The thing with Palm that I would love to know is how they're dealing with the fact that web developers are really, when they test for mobile compatibility, usually Palms aren't included. They look at BlackBerry and they look at iPhone, obviously iPhone. iPhone's always first. They look at BlackBerry, and, you know, those developers, when I've been in, you know, been in the process of helping you know, a client decide on someone for an RFP, you know, when I talk about multiple browsers or anything like that, it's really more about the device. So when we look at the devices, you know, why isn't the Palm included? So, I mean, that's one of my, you know, I have so many questions because obviously if they don't get included in the mobile compatibility portion of all of this, they may not succeed, you know, and that or continue to succeed, and they're just now seeing a resurgence, I feel, you know, from those people that have been, you know, because I think, you know, there was that time, I was a long-time Palm user before I switched to BlackBerry, and the only thing that made me switch was that at the time, and this was, probably 2 years ago now, maybe a year and a half, but when I would, you know, when they gave me the device, so I could see how quick it was to get on the web from my BlackBerry. And then I did the same thing on the Palm. It took so long for the Palm that I said, okay, I got to go with the BlackBerry. I'm just not an impatient person by nature. And, you know, of course, Palm has leapfrogged in the development of their products, and they've really fixed that issue. And I just
there's something in the open source community, too, which is, I think, smart.
Yes, and that, I mean, that's one of the things, and I, you know, and that's what brings me back to Apple, because I was reading again, I was actually laughing at it. It was either, so, you know, those of us that have the Firefox plugins or whatever that monitor different conversations. So I have friend feed and Twitter going, and it was late one night. And I think it was a chat room that Guy Kawasaki and Robert Scoble were in, and somebody brought up, God, what product did they bring up? They were talking about this topic though, and, you know, basically it somehow went from you know, talking specifically about little, you know, mobile handsets that are phones to then talking about micro or mini notebooks. You know, like the Acers and, you know, HP doing their big push through Verizon. And then people started talking about, you know, sort of tablets and that whole world. And there were people sending a series of links. So then I started getting really engaged because I wanted to see what the links were about all these rumors about Apple having a tablet somewhere. So I really wonder, I mean, because then I saw it a few places the next day, I think on Twitter. I think this was on FriendFeed that this took place.
Right.
But things like that where you hear, that these companies have products that they're kind of hiding from you.
Right.
In a
right.
sense. And it's funny the sense of entitlement that you can sort of feel towards,
yeah.
you know, okay, well, if Apple has a tablet, I want to know about it because I'd rather wait for an Apple tablet than a
right.
something else tablet, or that affects my purchasing decision in a sense.
Right. Becoming an evangelist for the company itself, yeah.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
and for them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a huge, huge portion of that, but I think that's a whole topic. But
mm-hmm.
one of the things that you just touched upon that I want to ask you about is open source. So
mm-hmm.
open source is a huge, you know, can be hugely helpful, can be frustrating at times,
right.
especially early
right.
stage. How are you dealing with and how are you including open source as part of the conference?
That's actually a great question. It's definitely something I need to think about more. It's a topic I'd love to see covered more because as an entrepreneur in the field, we had the constant question of, you know, well, is your coding going to be open source? What are you going to do? I just sat in with one of the lead developers for the Palm Prix talking about their struggles with open source because they need to monetize their content. They need to make sure, you know, another company can't come in and just grab it. At the same time, they want to make it as open source as possible. They want to engage with that community. I have to be honest, I haven't incorporated open source into my conference yet, but this conversation by itself is making me think I should. To bring in maybe even like a debate or two speakers to talk about what open source is doing. I mean, it's unifying the web. It's really helping ideas spread. I think it's a really great tool to have out there. I guess not really a tool, but a mentality to have out there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I understand with the businesses that they can't put everything online because we're not all trusting. You know, we're not all going to say, oh, of course we won't steal your code.
Yeah.
You need to make money. Money is the driving force. I'm a big fan of the companies out there that find ways to do social good but
mm-hmm.
are still monetizing. You know, it's money drives our what we do. And I feel like open source evangelists, the bigger people understand that. But what's important is finding a way to have open source that is profitable. So
and
I'm glad to see Palm approaching it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's the whole within the open source community, I used to work at Eastwick Communications, and one of the clients that they had brought on at the end was .NET Nuke. And I didn't realize that there was an actual open source community around .NET. Because
yeah.
When I think of .NET and Microsoft being part of it, I think, oh, well, there's no room for open source there.
Right.
I almost think that the PHP versus .NET open source discussion, debate has never happened. I mean, when we started doing research and I started doing the kind of groundwork community laying, you know, looking at what's happening on the ground, you know, you have these ardent fans of, you know, the .NET framework from an open source point of view. And it's just, it's
right.
amazing to me, you know, that sort of discussion really hasn't happened. It's like these two groups have kind of happened, you know, I mean, PHP groups and user groups and all that
right.
are much more developed, but you have these ardent, raving fans on the other side, too, and there's been
right.
I'm not even sure if there's a proof point about from a product point of view, you know, what kinds of products work better, what has a better success or failure rate,
mm-hmm.
who's tried what? You know, one of the questions that always comes up when I work with .NET folks is, you know, finding the people to code it.
Right.
And,
oh, yeah. So I don't know that I know anyone who knows .NET in my
yeah.
circle.
Yeah. Well, and the C, I mean, and that's the framework. So then you've got the C++ and the whole, you know, just
right.
the different levels of developers. And basically, the companies I've worked with that have had really kick butt developers in .NET, you know, that do C++ and that sort of thing, generally Eastern Europe, you know, for whatever reason has been the place that most of those folks have come from. So it seems like it's sort of happening outside the U.S. And, you know, clearly, you know, that's an area where it seems like Microsoft, you know, associating yourself with Microsoft outside this country, you know, is a huge opportunity,
right,
you know, for someone who's very clever and can do these kinds of things. So for my, you know, kind of a caveat to this is how much of the conference at all represents international successes and failures?
Wow, I have to say probably nothing. Yeah, I think part of that is my own oversight. I'm a big advocate of getting more diversity at conferences.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working really hard to get women and minority speakers. But then there's so many areas of diversity that you don't cover. For example, international companies.
Yeah.
So I don't really think that's partially my fault. Part of it is also international companies not reaching out.
Well, the conference hasn't happened yet. So we should tell people the conference isn't until October 24th,
right,
and she's already telling herself that she's failed at something. So you're going to have to get failure out of your head because you're a positive person by nature, it sounds like.
Right. Well, my next thing would be I'm still looking for about 6 speaking slots. As I said, I have about 40 submissions for them. But if anyone listening has an international story, do submit it. Because, yeah, I am still looking for speakers. I'm still looking to diversify the content. As I said, I wanted some of the tried and true, well-known names that would bring people, but I also want to get some people on stage that haven't been heard. And I think an international topic would be really interesting of how to spread. If you're in America, how do you reach an international audience? If you're international, how do you get, you know, an American audience? What are some of the different challenges that arise? I don't know them personally. That's a lot of where my conference organizing comes from, is what questions would I honestly have that I don't know the answer to? Who could I bring in? Because I definitely think the international community has a very different outlook on a lot of this than we do, what their goals are, what their drive is. I'm guessing every country
absolutely
has its own different outlook on it.
Well, you know, so my whole thing is, you know, I've been doing online video forever. And I worked at a startup called MediaZone that basically had all these different channels that were either niche or international. So I oversaw content for everything from a Desi channel, so Bollywood basically, that was kind of a competitor to Jaman, and to Wimbledon, to rugby, to Kudu Club, which was for expat South Africans. So it was a reverse BRIC strategy. So Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa was included in that, and pushing content basically to expats of those countries. And I can tell you some interesting stuff about, I mean, you know, the things that I think are interesting from a UI perspective even that folks don't think about was that when we were trying to templatize, so we were at the point where we weren't even on templates, but the template for, say, China Portal, which was one of the older international channels that we had, and I say older, it was like 3 years old at that point. The usability studies we had done had shown that the people that would use it wanted to see text. They didn't want to see images.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, let's say the UK audience, and especially the sporting audience, they wanted color and pictures and action. Even it trickled all the way down to email marketing, where, you know, we had, you know, we did the holiday special, and we had a rugby guy pop out of a box for one of the campaigns.
But
we would never do anything like that for China Portal or even for the Desi channel because of, you know, just the kind of storylines. I mean, if you really, having gone through, like, long lists of metadata for Bollywood video, some of the really, you know, the stuff that's been around a long, long time can have very sad backstories. And you're going, oh my God, I think of Bollywood and I think of dancing and happy, and you start reading and there's, you know, themes of rape and that sort of thing. And it does have song and dances in it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So you start watching it. And so I started watching lots of Bollywood movies. But I think what's interesting is just sort of, you know, even every aspect of the business was touched by that, by the international component, and having a lot of international affects a lot of different things. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about related to that was purchase process. Because, of course, for companies that are trying to do business in lots of countries, you're supposed to have a business, you're supposed to have a bank account in each country. And there have been few, really, in that I know of, few e-commerce solutions that have really been able to handle that. So in terms of, you know, the e-commerce portion of it, where we have, you know, obviously Max, you know, has his PayPal story. But I'm curious if there's other contingents from sort of the basics of the web besides the UI, but, you know, e-commerce and other parts that are just really essential to business on the web.
I mean, I definitely think in general we need to approach, we need to have someone at various conferences, if not my conference, talking about the entire international aspect, because it's getting easier and easier to get international. But I've also seen those studies where it's like how someone in China wants to read a web page, where they think the buttons are going to be. It differs from people in Norway, who differs from South Africa, the kind of products they're buying, how they interact. And so I don't really think just
their relationship to the phone is so different than our relationship to phones.
I have many friends who lived in Japan for 2 or 3 years, and they all talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. And, I mean, the part of that is the trust, which is sort of what started making me think about e-commerce, because that's obviously kind of the genesis of e-commerce, was getting people to buy in and be feel like they were, you know,
spend money on the web.
Whatever site had enough, you know, trust to be secure. And, you know, I'm going through that now with a nonprofit that I'm working with, and, you know, making sure that the symbols are there that make people feel like, oh, yeah, this is a secure transaction. Even
colors,
even
and the badges and the signs.
Yeah,
and there are
like
companies
that
out there working on it. I don't remember their names now, but I've seen it's obviously a hot issue. I know there's a conference in development on online e-commerce and money that I'll probably be working on for the winter. Tentatively called SF Money Tech, but not out there yet. But there's a lot of companies out there that I think people are recognizing this is an issue. That how do you change your prices? I know a lot of Facebook apps are working on, okay, my prices are in American dollars. How do I make sure that that's being spread to other countries properly, that my pricing is correct? It's a hot issue. I suggest more people get out there and doing it. There's a couple out there now. I know Mint.com and is working on how to make sure they can have a more international audience. And
I mean, it's amazing when I look at – so my husband happens to be English, so when I look at his family, and the way he uses the web, it's so completely different. I mean, part of it is the male thing. Part of it is he's a sports fanatic.
Of course.
And like every sport, not just, you know, what we think of as traditional American sports, but, you know, proper football, you know, European football. And as well as American football. I mean, he just loves any sporting competition, period. But to see the way that he is so connected and the way the web allows him to stay connected. I mean, like last night we watched yesterday's brand new Dragon's Den that aired, you know, obviously during the day our time. He downloads it from a site that is legal. And then we watched it last night on our Xbox. Our Xbox, and our PlayStation, and our media servers. So that kind of brings up an interesting point for me about gaming. So how much gaming will we see? Because all of us, I mean, think pretty universally can talk about, oh, my God, I remember I had this unit and I played this game, like dorky me.
I'm an avid gamer.
Yeah, so I started out with, I think, Legend of Zelda and the Cabbage Patch Kids game, which are on two different units, I think.
Odd pairing, yeah.
But, yeah, I know. My brother was really into the Legend of Zelda, and, of course, I couldn't stand to not be involved in, you know, some sort of competition. So, so had to do Legend of Zelda, and, of course, if it's not for a girl, I'm going to want to, you know, tackle it. And anyway, I'm just wondering, the gaming contingent, you had mentioned Nintendo. I'm wondering if there's some locals here from Sony and others. Anyone from the gaming industry that's going to have a really, hopefully, compelling story to tell us?
Well, we'll see. I'm in talks with, or I have some contacts at Sony. I'm looking to them. Because it's primarily, or based on the social web, I am inviting a lot of the online gaming companies, which... it's just a little more relevant to my audience because we're all they're coming from the social web world. So Zynga,
right.
Kongregate, Playfish, SGN.
Like Zynga. Zynga? Is that how you say it? Z-Y-N-G-A?
That's what I do, Zynga. Yep.
Yeah, so they were in the same building as one of the offices of my old company. So
there
I remember
they were building
it out, and I always wanted to go in there, and I never did, so I'll have to go back and say hi to people and stop by.
I mean, they own the entire building now, most of it. They're huge. So gaming is definitely involved. Actually, one of my early conferences was entirely based on gaming because I think it's a really hot issue right now. It's to tie everything together, going back to international as well, I think games are something that unites people across countries, as well as, let alone figuring out what China wants, we can try and figure out what the Midwest wants. You know, like, I feel like the Midwest is more foreign to Silicon Valley than India is.
Yeah.
It's where I'm from, and I know my friends are like, so you're on this Twittering thing? You Twitter? You know, and they don't get it. They are on Facebook maybe once a month just to peek in. They, you know, email. They check their email once a week.
I'm in the Peace Corps, so a lot of my friends, my really good friends, are from all over. And those that are in the Midwest, I can say some of the same things really ring true. And it's
right.
Just a different mode of thinking, I think.
Right. And you can still, I mean, the studies are now showing that, what is it, like, I mean, easily half of Internet users now, something like 52% even, are females. A lot of them are housewives, moms, that are playing these games.
Uh-huh. I was just going to say, mommy bloggers are one of the biggest,
mommy bloggers
for
are
me,
huge.
Surprise elements of
yep.
online gaming. I mean, there's
and
Yahoo,
mom gamers. Yep.
Yahoo Games is, it's more, it's just over 50% more female than male.
Yeah, I believe they just got a similar
incredible.
Statistic with their players are as much females as men, if not a little more, and a lot of them are moms. And so I think gaming is a really important thing to recognize, that it's showing where our culture is going, it's what games are we interested in, how are we making them viral, how are they spreading. I recently went into a company, and I was surprised to learn, it was an app development company, that they didn't track who was inviting whom and how often it was all clicked and who brought the most friends. And this is one thing that surprised me, is figuring out who your personal influencers are for your company. And I think gaming is a great way to learn who that is, because even if your company's goal isn't necessarily gaming, having gaming elements are so important. Just to recognize what makes something viral is a gaming aspect. So when we were working on our website, it wasn't a game website, but we were still discussing points and scores and sharing points and being able to beat people and having a high score list, which are all game terms, despite us having not being a game site at all. You know, and you see it now with Dig, and you see it with Hacker News, and any site that has a community, you see aspects, even Facebook a little bit of, like, who has the most friends, Twitter, who has the most followers. The
incentivizing through recognizing behavior,
right.
You know, trends and patterns. Companies like Bunchball are doing that so well. It's incredible. And I've had one of my early guests on the show was Kevin Spear from Bunchball. I love that whole idea of taking a forum and recognizing people that are answering questions correctly, saving a company money through their own goodwill, you know, and they find amazing statistics. And, you know, again, you have to track it. You have to, yeah, absolutely have to track that kind of thing and incentivize people, or they're just not going to, I think that we're going to see a drop off in participation at some point when people are more employed. People, I think, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, have more free time right now.
They play games.
So, and the other thing about, I think that's interesting about the point you were making about online gaming versus gaming through gaming units is, so when you know, we have all these different gaming units in my house, and for the most part, they're all used as more than a gaming unit. They're media servers, you know, that you know, stream over the internet. They're, you know, ways for us to talk in the living room with my in-laws overseas easily.
There are lots of
different things. I mean, they touch all different points of my life because they're a gaming unit. But or because they have lots of different functionality besides just
They become little media units. Yeah.
Yeah, but what's interesting is the bias I see when I tell my aunt, for example, oh, what are you going to buy your husband for, you know, for his birthday, or his, you know, what are you going to get for your anniversary? It's stuff, you know, it's you know, like another gaming unit, or it's, you know, I got a new receiver this for his birthday this year because it amplifies the sound better from the units and stuff like that.
Yep.
And she completely thinks he's sitting on the couch playing games all the time when
right.
he never gets a chance to play games. I never get a chance. I mean, we're big Rock Band fans. We hardly ever get to jam, right?
Yeah.
But we will totally buy the Beatles when it's out, and we'll buy the whole new kit and everything like we did when we got Rock Band 2. But, you know, it's there's very little time, and that's what I think is kind of interesting about the units themselves, because it's these days, I think there's clearly in the development of the actual box a learning from the failures of the past. You know,
oh,
the
yes.
Cabbage
I think
Patch
that,
game. Go ahead.
Yep.
Sorry.
I was just saying, I think that hard gaming units have some of the biggest and best stories to share. I mean, growing up, I had the E.T. game for my Atari, which
yeah.
is considered the game that almost ruined the video game industry. And I think you make an interesting point when you say you don't have time to play them, which is also part of why I'm not doing as much with the big gaming companies at the conference, because I think that's why online games are going to get hot, is that these units do take a bit of investment. You're going to sit and watch a movie on them. You're going to sit and have a conversation with a friend. You're going to play, like I'm currently playing through Oblivion, which is an Xbox 360 game.
Yeah.
And the minute I turn Oblivion on, I know I'm going to be there for the next hour. You know, I'm solving some puzzle. I'm getting through some dungeon. Where these online games literally take 5 minutes of your time. But I think even
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, go on. Oh, I was just going to say, I think the online games are learning from these boxes as well, figuring out, yeah, the systems were the first successes and the first failures, and there's so many great ones. I mean, I love the Virtual Boy. I'm still a huge fan of the Nintendo Virtual Boy, which I thought was so ahead of its time and was pretty much an epic failure.
And I'm sure we could go on and on. We only have a few minutes left. Thank you so much mm-hmm. for coming on. If you know of, or if anyone listening knows of, a great flight simulator game, because that's the other thing, is online games, I find they can be more educational than those that you
yes.
put
yep.
actually into the boxes, which is kind of interesting.
Huh.
But there's a great one Microsoft makes. I'm an Apple user, so if anyone knows of like a web-based flight simulator, I want to get my – I'm working towards getting my pilot's license, and my husband has said that there's a really good – Microsoft makes – or I guess it's Microsoft. I don't know if it just works on PCs or if it's a Microsoft program, but it's really good at helping you with those first stages of flight simulation, so you can start practicing, you know, in your free quote unquote time.
Right.
If you have any of that, but
yeah.
thank you so much, Cassie, for
thank
being
you, Jennifer.
On. I really appreciate it. Please go to my website, JenniferNeely.com. I'm sorry, JenniferLindsay.com, Neely's my maiden name, or SnapSummit.com for more about FailCon. And any other links, Cassie, that you have for me to add, I'm happy to add to the page for folks to check out.
Great.
And
you know.
With that, great. And we'll chat later. So in
yeah.
the meantime, I want to thank those that have tuned in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. For those of you looking to learn more about LinkedIn, join me for LinkedIn Nirvana, a webcast I'm hosting today at 3 p.m. Pacific. As always, as I said, you can keep up to date with the latest on this show and next week's guest at JenniferLindsay.com. Have a great weekend.